TalkZone.com.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
The name's Adam Weber, and I see that you buy baseball cards.
How much you want for this Mickey Mantle rookie season?
I was hoping to sell all of the cards.
TalkZone presents the Fan Cave Radio Show with your host, Tom Morgan.
This guy's unbelievable.
Featuring Phil Rogers of the Chicago Tribune and Dave Hoekstra of the Chicago Sun-Times. Sponsored by HoosierBat.com.
Wait, I'll make you a deal. I will give you a Rogers Hornsby if you take me to the hotel.
The show that can change your life.
Rogers Hornsby?
Just let your wife find out you're listening to a sports and memorabilia show on the internet.
Rogers Hornsby's worth like $4,000.
So what? I got two of them, and this many Larry Yogi Berras.
Sit back, relax, and learn a thing or two. It's the Fan Cave Radio Show on TalkZone.com.
Let's go to work.
Welcome to the Fan Cave Radio Show. I'm Tom Morgan with Phil Rogers of the Chicago Tribune, Dave Hoekstra of the Sun-Times, and our producer, Dave Olson. We're on live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 a.m. Central Time, and you can hear rebroadcasts anytime 24-7 of any of our shows at TalkZone.com. Well, we talked a lot last week about the whole Theo deal with the Cubs. Who would have thought we'd still be into it this week with nothing ended on it? What's going on, Phil? You're out in Boston checking out on things, huh?
Yeah, I've been lurking, I think you'd call it. It's a strange deal, the negotiations between the Red Sox and Cubs. But I mean, both those sides are really dug in, and you know, I don't think there's any question the deal goes through. But at what point does it? And you know, it's interesting. The Cubs, they've never valued their minor leaguers like they apparently do right now. Trey McNutt apparently is Bob Gibson. You know, it's really interesting to me. On the one hand, they're so thrilled to get Theo Epstein. On the other hand, they don't want to give up anything for him. So,
you heard any actual names? Is Trey McNutt a name, or is that all just kind of rumor?
Well, I don't know that anybody really knows where it's focused. I mean, I think it's a lot of names have been tossed out there, trotted out there. It's one of those stories. I have really not tried to write the back and forth lava flow between clubs, because I think a lot of what's getting written really is guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people say Brett Jackson is off limits. No way. But there aren't that many guys you can make off limits. And you know, at the very start, I wrote about, and this goes back more than a week when this process was starting, you know, would the Red Sox come after the Cubs for a Starlin Castro? It turns out Matt Garza was apparently the first guy Boston asked about. So it never hurts to ask, and a lot of different people have been discussed in this deal. And what's complicated it is, there are more guys coming from Boston. Actually, a very interesting, a couple really interesting developments last night that I thought Josh Burns, the assistant GM in San Diego, might come to. He had worked with Theo in Boston. I thought he might come to Chicago as Theo's handpicked number two guy. But now it looks like it actually might be the Padres general manager, Jed Hoyer, another guy who'd worked with Theo, who could be the number two guy, with Josh Burns then becoming the general manager in San Diego. The moving parts are fascinating. And there was also an interesting report that Ricketts is close and wants to pull away from Boston a guy who's like an executive vice president on the business side, who was very involved with all of the remodeling of Fenway Park and the tapping into different revenue streams at Fenway Park. So this whole thing is a giant umbrella that really pretty much covers every part of the Cubs business.
And they're all under contract, so... Yeah, Hoyer too. If they do get Hoyer, they have to give something up for him. Last week when you brought it up, that it seemed a little odd that they would get permission to talk to somebody without figuring what the compensation would be in advance. That does seem a little backwards right now, but to me, I think this is important for Ricketts in the eyes of the rest of baseball, to see how he handles this. Is he going to be a pushover, or is he going to be tough. So from that standpoint, I hope he hangs in there and remains tough with the whole deal. What do you think about it, Dave? I know you weren't that big on Theo to begin with. Now that we're a week longer into it, what do you think about the whole deal?
I'm really unhappy about the way it's all going down. And I don't know what they still don't know better than I about the repercussions. I mean, our team's having their fall meetings now. How far behind are the Cubs going to be in the eight ball in organizing stuff? I know contracts are up at the end of the month. I mean, I think they're going to be dragging behind. And the whole thing is just it's so Cub, you know. I would just walk away from it if they can't get it done. You're right. I never was into it. I'd rather have a GM who's a little hungrier. I don't like the big names outside of maybe Friedman. But I'm amazed. I went on this Kiss cruise with the rock band Kiss. I was telling all my friends, well, keep me posted. I want to see what's going to go on. I can't believe when I got off the ship on Monday morning, this thing was still going on. It's crazy. You know, we got our season ticket renewals, too, and it's just like, in a practical sense, they want you to re-up, you know, and it's like there's no general manager. There's a lame duck manager. So the cover letter of the season tickets are about all the Paul McCartney concerts and the Ferris Bueller day off at the. It's like we're getting season tickets to Great America and not a baseball team. It's just I'm really discouraged.
But that's how was that Kiss concert? Do you have any good stories you can clue us in on later or now? Or
I don't want to get off the track of this. Maybe later when we do the interview.
Yeah. Okay. Back to Theo, Phil.
Yeah. Well, I actually think Ricketts has been a big winner over the last week, and I think the Cubs franchise has been a winner in that Theo Epstein, who's universally respected. I mean, I've been reporting on this guy for a long time now, and nobody says anything bad about it. I mean, you know, you can nitpick some of the free agent contracts that they've signed. He certainly signed some bad ones. But from players, like Schilling was talking about how he's never been around a general manager who's set the tone at a clubhouse better, who's known how to deal with players, people who've worked with him in the front office. Kevin Towers, who's now the GM in Arizona, has talked about how Epstein gets everybody within an organization involved in meetings, and there's no backstabbing by these ambitious young executives, and it's just an incredibly creative idea market. And the fact that Theo would sign off on coming to the Cubs, I think, is the biggest endorsement by far that Tom Ricketts has had, and I think it goes back to the spending he did last summer on the amateur draft and Latin American players. I think that sort of signaled to the business that Ricketts is actually going to change the way the Cubs have done business. And, you know, I think this is going to wind up, it's an incredibly turbulent, confusing period for Cub fans. But I think, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, people are going to look back at it as when, you know, it was a huge crossroad and the Cubs merged onto the information superhighway and really sort of moved into the modern era, which many teams did, you know, over the last decade. The Cubs are in that holdover group of teams that haven't done it. You know, I think there's probably half have done and half haven't, and the Cubs have been in the slow adopting group of franchises, as are the White Sox, for that matter.
What is this fascination with Boston, though? I mean, why don't you create your own culture? Why don't you create your own image, your own thing? I mean, the next thing we'll be having clam chowder soup at Wrigley Field. I mean, he's just, it's why is he so fascinated with the Boston thing? It's from the, you know, I know the whole story about, you know, the same ballparks and all that, but I think he's overly fascinated with this whole Red Sox thing.
At Fenway Park, you can get legal seafood chowder. And so I would knock that, you know, compared to anything you could get at Wrigley.
And I'm also afraid that, you know, well, anyway, go ahead.
Well, you know, I think it's just the parallels between trying to turn the old stadiums into revenue streams. Now, if you're cut from the Cubs cloth that you don't want to see advertising, you know, on the walls, you don't want to see a jumbotron out there, whether it's across the street on a rooftop or somehow they figure out how to get one up beyond the scoreboards, you know, you're going to hate the next 10 years because, you know, they're totally going to attack all of that stuff.
And, you know, if you look at Fenway, what's been done there, compare to Wrigley, it's night and day. And, you know, I think Cub fans want it both ways. They want the Cubs to be the strongest team in baseball, but they don't want to really give them the revenue streams that the other teams, the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Phillies, those sort of teams have tapped into every possible way to make money. And, you know, the Cubs, to get that Under Armour sign on the outfield or that tiny little Toyota sign, you know, it's like you're digging up, Frank Chance's grave, maybe? I mean, who's Gabby Hartnett? Whose grave exactly would you be digging up? But, you know, the old Cubs history, and you're desecrating it to try to tap into these revenue streams. Well, if you want the team to win, you have to do that stuff.
Go, Dave. Come back.
I also disagree that I also am afraid that he's going to come in and really going to want to impress really fast. I don't think he's going to buy into like a 2 or 3 year rebuilding program. So I'm a little worried about, you know, him. I still think it's a big if he comes in, you know, trading prospects, getting rid of some of the star players, getting rid of Garza, you know, I think he's going to want to win immediately. I don't think he's going to want it on his image to try to build up a system and stuff.
Well, Dave, what do you think about the revenue streams with the different advertising? That doesn't bother you?
What they've done so far doesn't bother me. No.
Uh-huh. No. Now, isn't it pretty clear, Phil, that Theo's going to have a title that's actually higher than that of GM?
Yeah, that's how they're going to be able to hire two top executives.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that helped, Theo is a very, very private guy. He does not enjoy going out in the public and mingling. He will not be on the field behind, you know, the batting cage during batting practice, just talking with reporters like Hendry always was. I think that's part of the reason he needs a right-hand man to sort of be a more of a public face for the franchise. Theo's he's a think tank guy. He likes to stay behind the locked office doors, making his phone calls, doing his business, and, you know, he's not a glad hander.
So he probably convinced Ricketts remember originally Ricketts didn't want to have more than one baseball guy. He wanted a GM reporting directly to Ricketts, but there's now there's going to be Theo. There's going to be Ricketts, Theo, and then a GM under Theo, it looks like, right?
Yep, there's no doubt that Theo went to Ricketts and gave him a list of things he wanted / needed. And a big increase in the front office was one of them, and bringing in his own hand-picked number two guy was one of them. And you're right, in early October, I started to get a sense that they might wind up hiring, if they could get one of their top-tier guys, they might wind up hiring a second-tier guy as a number two guy, and he could get the GM title. I bounced it off of a guy close to Ricketts, and I was told not likely. But clearly, as conversations pursued, it went on the table, and the number of guys that are going to be there is going to be incredible. And people I feel really badly for right now are Randy Bush, the interim general manager, guys like Scott Nelson, who's been there forever as a sort of their waivers guy, administrative guy.
And
Chuck Wasserstrom is their information guy. How would you like to be in charge of analyzing stats for the old Cubs when these new guys are going to come in and set up their own computers? And, you know, that's one thing they did in Boston was they totally built a computer system to streamline information from wherever they want to get it all around the world, the ball players every morning. And, you know, it's a Red Sox computer. Well, there's going to be a Cub computer like that. It might be 2 or 3 years down the road while they spend the time replicating what they did in Boston, but
there's a lot of jokes that could be made about that, rebuilding a Cubs computer. Who knows what's going to be spit out of that thing?
I hope we save these shows, because 3 or 4 years down the line, I think we're all going to be in the same boat. I just don't understand this, like, superstar thing with Epstein. I really don't.
You know, the funny part, I was doing a little research on the money and everything. To me, if the Cubs are probably pointing what they want to give to the Red Sox is money. Because look at what, let's say, it looks like roughly Theo will be paid about $3.3 million a year for 5 years, roughly. That's what Jeff Samardzija was paid last year. That's actually the average Major League Baseball salary for 2011, $3.3 million, right about $3.3 million. So if you're looking at this guy as being the savior of your team, and all he's really getting paid is like a run-of-the-mill Major League player, I think you can probably afford to throw out some more money in order to get him when you want him. And it would seem to me that's what they're trying to do, rather than they don't really have talent to give up.
Yeah, I think you're dead on paying your executive. You know, I think Major League Baseball across the board is slowly coming to that realization that, you know, information is power. The guys who get the information can analyze the information, you know, can manage $100 million payroll. I did a thing on the White Sox front office and how, if you look at how they operate now, it's exactly like it was after the 2000 season when Ron Shuler turned it over to Ken Williams. Dan Evans, the assistant GM, left. Rick Hahn came in to be the assistant GM. And the size of the front office has stayed basically the same. To my knowledge, the way they operate has basically stayed the same. And when all that happened, their payroll was $30 million. And now, last few years, it's been $130 million. So does the same old system work? Is it actually efficient to keep running it the same way? Or don't you have to build up the manpower and, you know, reward the guys who manage the payrolls well? That the White Sox used to really, really manage payroll well, and I think it got away from them. And you know, if you had a guy like, you know, Rick Hahn, I think, is a guy that has done this and could do this, you know, managing the payroll well, why wouldn't you pay him some of what he's not spending on, you know, $5 million relief pitchers?
Since we're on the White Sox subject, we talked about Ventura being hired, but we never really got around to the whole Cooper, Ozzie, Kenny loyalty thing, where Coop signs long-term with the White Sox. Ozzie felt like Cooper was going behind his back and was a traitor, basically. But Cooper's known Kenny for longer than, I think, since the mid-90s. Haven't they, like kind of been together? So, for one thing, that's a bad, you know, there was a bad, you said that Theo doesn't do a lot of the backstabbing and all that stuff. It sounded like the White Sox, all the politics and the who's talking to who and all that stuff was way out of control. And,
you know,
That goes right on to Kenny Williams, where he's the guy in charge. The guy in charge stops that, you know, doesn't allow it to happen. If that means you get rid of the manager or whatever. But the question would be, do you think Cooper's in the right or in the wrong if he didn't necessarily agree with the way Ozzie was doing things or whatever? Should he have been signing a contract on his own with Kenny when Ozzie wasn't and kind of going behind his back, or was he? I guess if that question makes sense. What do you think about that, Phil?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm as big of a critic as there is on Kenny Williams, but I look at the performance, the roster, the guys that are there. I know Joe Cowley of the Sun-Times is also a huge critic of Kenny, but he looks at the personalities, the politics, and, you know, I'm not sure a lot of the stuff that's been written isn't stuff you could write about just about anybody if you had the manager talking to you the way Ozzie talks to Joe Cowley. I think that's sort of the piece here, is you got Ozzie who'll say anything and probably say something different 3 hours later, and you know, Joe has never really held Ozzy accountable for anything that's fallen apart. He, you know, he's totally thinking Ozzy being pushed away from the White Sox was a terrible thing. You know, not looking at the fact that, hey, Ozzy had to be interested in that deal in Florida to begin with. And his interest in Florida probably caused his attention to this job to fade a little bit. So I think a lot of it is just really interesting for some people to talk about. I don't know how much it's worthwhile. And as for Don Cooper, I've never heard of one coach going there, going and talking about approach to talk about a contract extension and say, well, yeah, but what about the hitting coach? You know, you got to give Greg Walker the same deal as me. I don't really recall that ever happening. Larry Rothschild always had deals with the Cubs.
Right.
It went beyond anybody else. But I think that's the way almost every team operates. You have coaches who, right or wrong, you value. And Cooper's been a guy the White Sox have valued. His performance has been very good. I mean, you know.
Well, that's where I agree with that. That's where I completely disagreed with Ozzie's whole. Ozzie wanted to have control of the coaches. They reported to him. He talked to Kenny. He didn't want his coaches talking separately to Kenny, and he felt like Cooper's a traitor or whatever for doing that. But I agree with you. For one thing, I think Cooper never got enough credit for the White Sox World Series. I mean, look how important that pitching staff, how he maneuvered them through the playoffs. And that's Cooper. That's not Ozzy that was handling that. But Ozzy was always good for taking the credit and getting the publicity and everything about it. So I don't know. I think long term, the White Sox decided who's more important to keep long term, our pitching coach, who's one of the best in baseball. He's pitcher after pitcher have come in and he's turned them from borderline even still being in the majors into borderline stars. Or Ozzy, who's the last couple years turned into a guy who seemed more interested in being a social media star than in winning. So from that standpoint, you got to kind of back the White Sox point on that one.
Here's one last quick thing on Cooper that I don't know that if Joe Calley, anyone else has written this recently or not, but a year ago when the Yankees hired Larry Rothschild to be their pitching coach, they first approached the White Sox to talk to Don Cooper.
Right.
The White Sox would not give Cooper permission to talk to the Yankees about that job because they valued him here. So his next deal with the White Sox would figure to be impacted by that they held on to him and didn't let him go explore an opportunity elsewhere. And, you know, just
you should write about that one, Phil. You actually should write a story about that because that's key. I think that you're right. That's 100% right.
Yeah, you're exactly right. This is such a crazy period in baseball. There's more things to write than I've had time to write.
Yeah, that's true. But if you ever have a downtime, that's something that anybody who's critical of what Cooper has done, they need to understand that he was, that's exactly right. He was contacted by the Yankees and the Sox kept him. So obviously you're going to give him a deal, and obviously you're going to deal with him separately from the other coaches because of that.
If you hadn't given him that contract in September, his contract runs out now, and then you're trying to hire a coach, he might have gone to the Cubs. He might have gone someplace else. I mean, you know,
right.
If he's not in a contract, he's a free agent. So he had leverage.
He had leverage, plus he was identified by the White Sox as a key guy they didn't want to lose. So what, he's supposed to not sign a deal? You know what I mean? Now, speaking of signing deals, the NBA apparently met for 16 hours yesterday. There's a gag order on both sides, and they're supposed to start meeting again this morning. So we don't know how far they advanced in trying to get something done, but I suppose that has to be promising that at least they're talking. If they come out of this, though, and they're no closer, then it's going to be a long one. So this next couple of days is going to be pretty key to find out how long this thing might go.
One drawback to these talks that I see is these talks they're having now are at the order of a federal mediator.
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of have Big Brother watching to see you sit there so that you're at the table and talking that long. You know, both sides are now put on the gun that they don't want to be labeled as not bargaining in good faith. But until you get to a real crunch, I saw this in baseball. You know, federal mediators are sort of a dog and pony show from my perspective. So I'm pessimistic that, you know, that would really be significant of anything that they were at the table that long, unless the financial crunch is there. I thought what was interesting in the last week or so was David Stern saying he's just going to shut the game down until after Christmas. I don't know why you would do that when you still have 2 months to go. It seems like you could hustle up and have a 3 or 4 week training camp and then start the season. But I think that's just trying to pressure the players to say,
I think that's been Stern's plan all along, to be honest with you, is make the players miss a few paychecks and then see how much they're willing to cave. Then when it gets by the end of the January time frame, where they can still have roughly a 45 or 50 game season in the playoffs, the owners will get whatever they can get out of it and they'll get the season started. I think really that's been the plan the whole time. All this Stern talking with, the season's going to end and his ultimatums and all this stuff. I really think that's their plan. Make the players sweat for a while and miss a few paychecks. I don't know. That's why it would be, if something came out of this today, I'd be very surprised. I don't think they're going to start. This would mean maybe they start like the third week in November with the schedule, something like that, which also would mean the Bulls would start the season with their circus trip. That wouldn't be too exciting. But I've thought all along that January is probably when they're going to get going. If teams if 22 teams are truly losing a lot of money, like they say, which who knows what to believe with that. Now we've been getting some emails. And I'm going to just try to work a couple in. I want to work one in, and this ties in a little bit. The emails aren't only about collectible items. We got one that said, "Hey, Tom, don't know if you guys have chewed this thought yet, but here's a question for you. Where do you, Phil, and Dave think a Cubs World Championship will rank as far as historic sports accomplishments?" Dave, you start with that one. Where does it fit in your scheme of things?
Well, you know, I'm loaded here. I mean, I'm a Cubs fan. I mean, I've always told people it'd be like the cover of Time magazine. Historically, I mean, modern day, I think it'll be top. I used to argue with my Boston fans. As a Cubs fan, all I want to do is just see a World Series game at Wrigley Field. I mean, even before Theo, they got in the World Series. The Red Sox did stuff in it. I think just them getting the World Series, them winning a World Series would be a modern day. I think pretty much. I'm trying to think off the top of my head, like repeat, you know, like the Oakland A's, like, you know, 3 in a row, stuff like that. But the Cubs winning after
Hundred three, I think.
That's just off the charts. That's off the charts.
I was thinking when I saw this question, I thought, well, a couple of the biggest things that happened, the Mets in 69 was pretty unbelievable that they came from as bad as they were to actually winning it all in that 1 year. And then the Jets winning the Super Bowl over the Colts was so big for the AFC, and then it really changed the NFL. But it would have to at least rank right up there with the Jets, yeah. Colts, I would think. You know, yeah. What do you think, Phil?
Well, it would sure make Steve Bartman happy if it ever happened. What did you say?
Yeah,
I think it's inevitable. You know, I don't know. Maybe I am too flat of a view of sports and too much perspective. But, you know, one of these years, probably in our lifetimes, we're all in our 50s, you know, knock on wood. I don't think it's going to be forever till it happens. You know, the gods have to line up. They had at least two good chances in the last decade and blew them in 03 and again in 08. So I think it will happen. And what would be, how about expand your question and have the Cubs become one of the true powers in baseball and be a team that can get to the World Series in back-to-back years? How about the Texas Rangers, who are really the Washington Senators, are now in the World Series in back-to-back years? I mean, that's pretty darn remarkable when you consider the woeful history of that franchise.
Well, we have to break now. A short break coming up. We'll come back with Hoekstra Chicago, the KISS concert tour details, talk a little bit about the World Series and Bucks in the Belfry. So hang in there, everybody. We got a lot still to talk about.
The solid sound of wood hitting a leather ball. That's the way baseball started, and that's how Hoosier Bat Company believes the game should be played. They've been providing bats to minor and major leaguers for 20 years. They offer ash bats, birch bats, and their patented Wood Force 2000, a bat with hickory in the sweet spot for great hits. View their products online at HoosierBat.com and see why players at every level have come to appreciate their quality and customer service. You can also visit them at 4511 Evans Avenue in Valparaiso, Indiana, or call 1-800-228-3787.
Rosati's of Naperville and Carroll Stream is the place for great pizza and more. They use only the finest ingredients. That's why Rosati's mouthwatering menu can't be beat. Rosati's delivers for lunch daily. In Naperville, call 630-305-3500. In Carroll Stream, 630-653-9009. That's Rosati's of Naperville and Carroll Stream.
Southside Cards and Collectibles is your one-stop shop for premier cards and collectibles. No matter what your hobby, baseball, football, basketball, hockey, NASCAR, gaming, or more, Southside Cards carries all the new packs and boxes from Upper Deck, Topps, Panini, and Press Pass. You'll also find memorabilia and supplies. Come in today and see for yourself. Southside Cards is open every day but Monday. They're located at 11325 West 143rd Street, Orland Park, Illinois. Call 708-873-5088 or visit them online at southsidecards.com. Southside Cards and Collectibles, your one-stop shop for premier cards and collectibles. Call 708-873-5088 or online at southsidecards.com.
This is a new dimension in sound.
You're listening to TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
TalkZone.com.
Time for another edition of Hoekstra Chicago. Take it away, Dave.
Apologize for the Ziggy Marley Theo Epstein coming out party last week that I promoted. I guess.
Didn't quite happen.
Didn't happen. We have a well-read audience, I know that, and there's a little under-the-radar book called Flying Saucers Rock and Roll, done by a pal of mine, a good White Sox fan, Jake Austin. And for many, many, many years, he's run this fanzine called Rocktober, just really, really in-depth interviews and profiles of mostly forgotten musicians, under-the-radar musicians. Over the years, there's been stories on Sam the Sham, you know, who did Wooly Bully at the Bulls game. They play at the Bulls games now. And David Allan Coe. I'm sure Phil's a big David Allan Coe fan. Oscar, the late, great Oscar Brown Jr. from Southside Chicago. Anyway, he put all those together in a book, and they're having a book launch party. This is on Tuesday night. We don't get into that much high culture here, but it's on Tuesday night at 6:30 at the Chicago Cultural Center in the Claudia Cassidy Theater. That would be at 78 East Washington, downtown.
And Tuesday night.
Yeah, that's this Tuesday night. And he'll have copies of the book, but he'll also have a very unique performer, a guy named Milt. I'll be real brief on this, but a guy named Milt Turnier, who was part of the last living member of the Turniers, of three brothers. I wrote about them years ago for the Reader. And they were big, like, in the 40s and 50s. They kind of bridged the gap there between blues and rock and roll. They were in that 1956 movie, The Girl Can't Help It. They ran a great nightclub for like 20 years in Chicago called Milt Turnier's, like 77 to 97. So I'm guessing Milt's got to be in his early 80s or something. But he'll be performing at this thing, which is kind of a cool little sidebar to the event. So the writing is top-notch. Jake's just a great guy, a huge baseball fan. And then you get a chance to see Milt Turnier, who I don't think even lives around. I think he lives in Vegas, but he's coming in for this. There's a profile of him in the book. It's all free, and I'll be there. I'd recommend it.
You ought to see if you can get him on as a guest sometime, Dave.
I know, when we were doing the commercials, I was just thinking of that.
Yeah, baseball fan, and I bet he'd be interesting. That'd be fun.
I ran into him one time at first year of the Schaumburg Flyers. I was sitting, I think they had bleachers there, but it was Ron Kittle bobblehead day, and we were both there to get our Ron Kittle bobblehead. But it had to be, I think Kittle was one of their first managers. But he's a huge baseball fan. Yeah, we'll do that.
What's his name, Dave?
Jake Austin. Not like the city, Austen. He also does a cable show called Chicagogo. It's like a Soul Train show. He does it on like an access station. And, you know, kids dance to old R&B songs and stuff. He's quite a guy. So Tuesday night. But yeah, I'll get him on to promote the book.
Yeah, and the book is Flying Saucers Rock and Roll, it's called?
I'll be out your way Monday. And maybe I'll bring a copy of the book for you and you can look at it.
Yeah, good.
Oh, then we'll get them on.
Now, what about the Kiss thing you went on? What was that? You were on a boat?
It was the first. There's really no such thing as a first annual, but it was the first, and it will be an annual. I think it went so well for them. Kiss Cruise.
Kiss Cruise.
They had the rock band Kiss, and we left Miami on, I can't remember, Friday morning. And I got back Monday morning and went down Nassau back toward Miami, where the weather was kind of like what we have in Chicago today. It was really rainy. I think we're getting some of that up here. And it's just like a lot of these other cruises. This whole musical cruise thing has also taken off, where it's just you're immersed in a band's history and a band's music for like 3 or 4 days. You're a captive audience. So Kiss played 3 shows. They did 2 Fully Masked. I'm not the world's biggest Kiss fan. I just went as a reporter. But they did 2 Fully Masked shows. It was very unique as the send-away cruise. When we took out of Miami, they played Unplugged, Unmasked show with all their greatest hits and stuff. It was actually kind of neat. They had about 2,000 people. Many, many, many people dressed up like Gene Simmons. And you know, they had to face the black and white grease paint on their face, sticking their tongues out and stuff. It was a very, very, very weird trip. Hey,
Dave, are you a Chuck Klosterman reader?
Yeah, I know of him. Yeah, I've read a little bit of. He's got a couple of books. I've read him in magazines, though, right?
Yeah, he's Spin Magazine, and he's written some sport, and I think he's really one of the better modern contemporary just writers of culture. And he grew up as a big heavy metal fan in North Dakota, and he wrote a book called Fargo Rock City. Kiss is his favorite band. I wouldn't be surprised if he was hiding away on that cruise.
I'll have to check that out. You know, it was been years since I've actually heard that, but then their electric shows, the shows they did in this little theater on the ship. There they did like a lot of just rarities from the 70s and 80s. Because, I mean, people paid like $2,000, $2,500 to go on this thing. They're all hardcore fans. And so, you know, they gave them that type of treat.
Did you get any good beach time?
You know, we only went to 2 ports. We went to Half Moon Cay, where it was really nice weather. And by the time we got to Nassau, it started getting rainy and cloudy. The funny thing is that kind of bothered some of the fans. We spent overnight in Nassau because Kiss got off the ship and flew home. they didn't finish the trip. I guess they said that Gene Simmons had some Family Jewel stuff to do for the A&E show, and then Paul Stanley had to go actually to Boston, they said, to look at go to a throat specialist. I think the drummer might have stayed on. Somebody said they saw him in the casino on the last night and stuff, but so they jumped ship.
That sounds like a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young cruise where you never know when they're going to split up.
Yeah. But it was fun.
Were there all-night parties going on, like wild all-night parties, or was it kind of late?
I went to a Q&A. I've been on one musical cruise before, like about 5 years ago. I did a story on a rhythm and blues cruise, and there was more of that. I mean, there were sets that started like at midnight, 1 o'clock. You know, I remember Pine Top Perkins and Bobby Bland and Millie Jackson. They were all on that. They had shows that started pretty late. And so anyway, on Sunday afternoon, they had a Q&A with the promoters, Six Man. They're out of Atlanta. And a couple fans said that they thought there was too much downtime. And, you know, you rock and roll all night, you know, all that. It really wasn't so much like that. They had, like, little offshoot things. They had, like, Kiss Karaoke and Kiss Lookalike Contest, Kiss Trivia Contest. They had other bands. Sunday night, I know these guys, Skid Row, they're out of New Jersey. Kind of a speed metal band. They played Sunday night. But Sunday night, I spent a lot of time in the sports bar watching the baseball and the Bears and stuff. They had a little sports bar there. But not so much as you would think. And I think if they do this again, they are going to beef it up and have more, you know, a little bit more bands and a little more late-night activity.
Hey, before we get away from musicians, my guy Astro Nautilus, our guest of a couple weeks ago, big baseball fan, he tweets this, and I just want you to put this thought in your head as you watch Game 1 of the World Series tonight. Tony La Russa looks like a drag queen dressed up as Pete Rose. What do you think? Discuss. I think he may be onto something.
I always thought he also looked a little bit like Johnny Cash, like a green-out Johnny Cash.
Too, yeah.
Hey, you know, I got something for you guys. This goes back to the sports bar, but they had the volume up. I thought this was kind of interesting. I forgot. I don't know who the feed was because they had a ESPN Latin feed, so I don't know who the announcers were. I don't know even if they were being dubbed because the voices didn't sound familiar to me. But anyway, somebody brought up the fact that Dave Duncan could be the first coach, or maybe the first pitching coach, maybe the first coach in the Hall of Fame. I thought that was kind of compelling.
I've heard that before. What do you think about that, Phil?
Well, I think they should have coaches in the Hall of Fame, but they don't. So I think that'll be a short discussion. What they do have now is the Buck O'Neill Award every year, which is what Roland Heeman was recognized with last year. And for all practical purposes, 90% of people think Roland Heeman was inducted into the Hall of Fame last year. He wasn't. He was recognized by the Hall of Fame. And this Buck O'Neill Award is a good thing that allows the Hall of Fame to reach out to scouts, coaches. I mean, they're pretty particular. You have to be an executive, umpire, manager, or player. So, there are a lot of guys that really don't have entree. And, you know, unless Dave Duncan was a Hall of Fame catcher, he's not going to get in.
Phil, as a Hall of Fame voter, give us a little rundown on how it actually works. Do they send you the ballots and say you have to get it returned by a certain date, or how does it work?
Well, there's two different sides of that. There's the Baseball Writers Association, which is what I vote in, and that's when players are first on the ballot, their first run through. And then there's the Veterans Committee and the other ways. And those rules change all the time. But the BBWA rules haven't changed since, like, basically forever. And you will get the ballot early to mid-December, and it's due back December 31st. And then it will be compiled and usually released about a week later. And most voters that I know of just
sort of pore over the ballot and agonize over their choices. And, you know, I'm sure there are some, but I don't know many people who, when that ballot shows up, just sit down at the kitchen table and say, okay, this guy, boom, off it goes. I think guys sit down with their computers, or they'll talk to people whose opinions they respect and really, really pore over it and weigh it. I think it's an honor and a privilege to be a voter. There's 500 and something of them. But it's also in many ways a thankless task, because, you know, you can screw it up and become immortalized, because baseball writers, we have an open policy. We'll disclose all our votes, Cy Young ballot, everything. So, you know, you could wind up unintentionally making news. I think that happens sometimes with the MVP Cy Young vote. But a couple of years ago, or not a couple, probably 10, when Pedro Martinez almost won the MVP, two guys left him off, and those guys were identified, and they had reasons for why they left him off. But I always wondered if one of them might have just forgotten to consider him as a candidate, and then when it comes out that he didn't vote for him, he has to take a stance that, well, I don't believe pitchers belong on the ballot. I've always really sort of wondered if maybe he just forgot, because it'd be awfully easy to do when you're doing those ballots.
What do you think about like stuff like the New York Times not letting writers vote?
I guess I can see that, but you know, I think the AP doesn't let their writers vote either. And you know, ultimately, you know, I've thought about with the Hall of Fame, because I would like to see the Hall of Fame give us some directions on steroids. How they want voters to treat that era. I don't think they ever will, though, because as it is, we make the decisions and take the heat. But you know, I don't know of anybody more qualified. So if, you know, if you don't let a lot of guys vote, then I think you're going to wind up letting less qualified people in. But obviously, I'm not objective because I have a vote.
Do they give you any directions at all?
On the awards?
On the Hall of Fame ballot, like look yeah, for this, I mean, or do this, or don't do that, or...
I mean, there are guidelines, but they've been the same guidelines forever. You know, like, sportsmanship is a guideline. It may say character, or people may take the sportsmanship to translate it into character. So there were guidelines drawn up a long, long time ago. The first year the ballot came out was 1936, and I think the last changes, these are the annual awards, was in the 1960s. So, you know, I don't know why you wouldn't put together a committee, a think tank, and come up with the guidelines that the Hall of Fame wants to be followed now, because there was no DH, you know. I mean, how are Hall of Famers voters supposed to consider guys who are DHs a lot of their career? Some guys punish them, some guys don't. And, it, you know, it's my line now on steroids is 530 voters, 530 standards. And, you know, that can apply to the other awards too.
Well, that's like, where did it come in? So there's nothing in there about you should pay closer attention or on the player's first year on the ballot. Who came up with the idea that, well, I don't vote for guys their first year, but later on? There's nothing in the rules. That's just guys came up with that along the way, apparently, or a small group of guys.
Yeah, I think that became an unofficial line of distinction when, okay, well, this guy's better than other guys. You know, he's no Ted Williams, so I'm not putting him in the first year on the ballot. And through history, it sort of became a tradition that there's a, you know, almost like a separate wing for first-time ballot guys, which there isn't. So I've never really looked at that. And I have always thought it was sort of an older guy development. I thought it was when I started covering, there were these old guys that were now probably as old as I am, but I considered the old guys.
Yeah.
And I thought they were the guys that would just sort of, well, no, he was no Ty Cobb, screw him.
And I thought that would sort of pass through time, but it really hasn't. So, you know, I think there are younger guys that still uphold that tradition of there's, you know, a different standard between your first and second year. You know, I changed my vote in part because there's so many good candidates. You can't vote for, you can vote for nobody, or you can vote for a maximum of 10 players. I don't know if I've ever voted for 10, but I've come close sometimes. And there have been guys like Dave Concepcion would be one who I voted for. I used to vote for Steve Garvey. And after a while, when you're voting for a guy and he's not getting in, you know, I have given up on guys and say, okay, it's a lost cause, and dropping them off my ballot this year and vote for somebody else. But, you know, Bert Blyleven's an example of a guy that built up support through the years. I think I always voted for him. But, you know, year to year, your view of a guy might change. You know, I mean, people say, and it's an accurate point, well, what difference? Did he have a good year this year not playing? I mean, why would a guy get more votes one year than the next year? But, you know, our appreciation of all elements of history is, revolves. It evolves. It changes. So, you know, to be bound by what you did the year before doesn't make a lot of sense to me either.
Yeah. The whole part about it that I just found it very odd. I've always found it very odd that no one ever got 100% in the first year.
Who's not going to vote for Greg Maddux and why?
Right. But you know he won't get 100%. I mean, nobody's got, so somebody out there will be like, well, I got to make sure he's not 100%. I don't get it.
They do identify who those guys are, and they try to explain why they didn't vote for him. Because, it is crazy. I think Nolan Ryan now might have the highest percentage first time around. And, you know, he holds the record for most losses all time. There are reasons you can point to for not voting for him. But
man, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Mickey Mantle, all these guys, you know, Ted Williams, they weren't 100%. I just can't believe it. Well, we're running out of time here. I better get to my Bucks in the Belfry segment before the show's over and we're holding off till next week. So I had a customer. This Famous Fabrics product has been unbelievable. This is the product that had the Muhammad Ali one-of-one cut signature and the Maguire emblem, and all kinds of neat product has come out of it. But a guy yesterday pulled a Babe Ruth one-of-one memorabilia card. And actually, the customer who had pulled the Muhammad Ali one-of-one cut signature was standing right next to this customer when the Babe Ruth came out. Real neat-looking card. It's a 500 home run club type card where they're one-of-one memorabilia cards of all the guys that are 500 home run hitters. So the Babe Ruth one-of-one came out yesterday, and to me, that's, if you have a card like that, if you're going to sell it, you don't want to sell it for under $1,000. I don't even know what that would go for in an auction, but I wouldn't want to sell it for anywhere under $1,000. And then next item, I do have this one for sale on my T-Crown Tom eBay seller ID, Ryan Braun autograph. What a playoffs he was having. And I was rooting for the Brewers to win, but unfortunately they didn't make it. I seem to always root for anyone who's playing the St. Louis Cardinals in the playoffs. I'll always be rooting for the other team. I bet you're like that too, Dave, aren't you?
Cardinals, I mean, you mentioned, we were talking about this at work yesterday, you mentioned the 69 Mets. The Cardinals are on one of those rolls. I mean, you know, they're really not going to, I would not call them the best team in baseball.
No, they've done this before, though, with La Russa, where the year they beat the Tigers in the series, they do get on. But boy, I really don't like Tony La Russa. You know, great career, he'll be in the Hall of Fame for sure. But something about him that's unlikable.
Oh, he's awful.
I have a quick thought how to improve the World Series. Throw it out there, see what you guys think.
Yeah.
Limit the number of pitchers on a World Series roster. Say 10. Would be a pretty reasonable number. So you don't have the incredible pitch, you know, four pitching changes innings that you get with Tony and some other managers now. And sort of keeps the game flowing, makes a relief pitcher be able to get out left-hander and right-hander, and it might create more drama in the late inning. What do you think about that?
I like that. I like that.
Yeah, I'd have to think about that one, but my original thought is, I kind of like that too. Pitching changes, geez, it's like, when did all of a sudden 12 pitchers on a roster? Remember, they'd have 8 or 9 guys at one point. It's there. There's so much of that now. It does get, it really bogs down the game.
The Roots is showing all the love for Octavio Dotel. It's like, every time I look at it, you just bring in Dotel in.
Or how about,
and then they brought him in twice the same game the other night.
What'd you say, Phil?
Mark Rachevsky, that's in all the time. I think it's Progressive Field in Cleveland that actually has 3 bullpen mounds out in the bullpen. It's perfect for Tony. About 3 relievers at once.
Yeah, not a big fan of La Russa. Like I say, he's a lock for the Hall of Fame, and Duncan will probably make it, but not a big fan. And another item for sale on the T Crown Tom eBay seller ID, and you can get to these at tcrowntom.com. I have a Nelson Fox cut signature autograph. Now, he almost always signed his items Nelson. So if you ever see something signed Nelly Fox, be leery that whether it might be real or not. If it's authenticated by PSA DNA or JSA, fine. He did apparently sign Nelly once in a while, but well over 90% of the items I've ever seen, he signed Nelson Fox. And he died at such a young age in the 70s that, his autographs do real well, and there's not a ton of his signatures out there. I'm pretty sure, remember, he was always known for having the big wad of chewing tobacco? Do you guys know for sure, but didn't he die of cancer, like throat cancer or something, which was a result of that? You guys know about that?
Yeah, you could be right. He definitely died young.
I'll have to look that up, because I'm pretty sure that's how he died, and that was his almost claim to fame, I guess, was the, you know, he had the big wad of chewing tobacco at all times in the side of his mouth. And the final item, the team I'm rooting for in the World Series, the Texas Rangers, because as much as anything, they're up against the St. Louis Cardinals. There's a Michael Young autograph, kind of an underrated player over the years. This guy seems to get 200 hits every year. Excellent clutch hitter, Michael Young autographed card on the T Crown Tom eBay seller ID, and you can get to these items at tcrowntom.com. Dave, are you going to be watching the World Series, or with these teams, just 2 teams you really don't care about?
I'll watch it. I wonder what the weather's like in St. Louis tonight. I mean, I think this whole system is through the whole Midwest. But yeah, I'll be watching it. I'm pulling for the Rangers too.
It's going to be cold and rainy, and I'm going to be underdressed, and I have to make a connection through O'Hare to get there. So maybe I won't actually be at the game, but. How about this on your other thought? Michael Young equals Paul Molitor.
That's good.
That's a real good comparison, actually. You know, one change that I like, and we're coming up to the close here, but one change that I do like that they've made is that this World Series will get done in October. So I hope they keep it that way. As they kept getting farther into November with the games, I didn't like that. So. It's time for the end of another show. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Tom Morgan with Phil Rogers of the Tribune, Dave Hoekstra of the Sun-Times, and our producer, Dave Olson. Listen live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 a.m. and rebroadcast 24/7. Have a great week, everybody.